Thank you everyone for coming. Thank you, Henrietta, for the invitation. It's lovely to be here. I think that's the most comprehensive bio or introduction I've ever had. So thank you so much, Natalie. So maybe I'll get started. Looking particularly at, this is the sort of first case study I came to when I started to think about rivers in this way, as have been described just now. So I try not to go into too much graphic detail, but really focus on the ways in which the river tells different kinds of stories and memories, and the ways in which it might hold trace, or we can imagine it might hold traces of events which it's presumed to erase. But I will talk about that in far more detail now. So then what I'm going to talk about now is a riverine tale of fragments. And so I'll start with a group of fragments, some of them material, some of them literary, some of them mythological, some of them cultural. And to do so, I'll look at a few things that I've gleaned from elsewhere. So field notes, but also epigraphs from other writers. So this is from some field notes I wrote in 2018. Set back from the road, separating the river from the rear of the museum, access to the Sowa is obstructed by a long green fence bearing signs for both the museum and municipal waterworks. Here, at the western edges of Osviensim, the river is on one of its final shallow turns, for it opens out into the Wisła and then flows through Poland and eventually to the Baltic. Walking down onto the thin pebble beach, I come across the remains of what was presumably a fisherman's fire. It is hard to tell whether the dark marks on the pebbles are scorched black by those flames or hold a residual dampness from the river itself. Remaining at the water's edge, I contemplate the wind carrying these ashes away or into the Sowa's gentle flows. So the first epigraph from Primo Levi's entry on lead in the periodic table, a kind of memoir. He writes, I went down to the stream, which was rather swift. I remember that its water was turbid, a dingy white, as if it had been mixed with milk, something which in my parts was unheard of. And I set about patiently examining the stones. This is one of our tricks. The stones in a stream come from afar and speak clearly to him who understands. There was a little of everything. Flint stones, green stones, limestones, granite, iron-bearing stones, even a little of what we call gameda, all stuff that did not interest me. And yet I had the fixed idea that in a valley formed like that, with certain white striations on the red rock, and with so much iron thereabouts, lead rocks could not be missing. And then from one of Rachel Carson's early texts, The Sea Around Us. From the moment the rains began to fall, the lands began to be worn away and carried to the sea. It is in an endless, inexorable process that has never stopped. The dissolving of the rocks, the leaching out of their contained minerals, the carrying of the rock fragments and dissolved minerals to the ocean. And over the eons of time, the sea has grown ever more bitter with the salt of the continents. And finally, from the specific case that I'm looking at, an excerpt from Oscar Flatt's The Banks of the Wisła. He writes, whose heart hasn't been struck by the Wisła's shores? Aren't these shores an open book of history? In August 2015, drought caused the Wisła, Poland's longest river, to fall to its lowest levels since records began in 1789. Linking Krakow to Warsaw and eventually flowing into the Baltic at Gdansk, the Wisła is a prominent symbol of Poland's national mythology. The 2015 drought heralded what climate scientists project to be continued patterns of lowering summer river levels in Central and Eastern Europe. The reduced levels contributed to an unexpected archaeology. Exposed riverbeds revealed Baroque marbles, a World War II Soviet fighter plane, and tombstones from a desecrated Jewish cemetery near Warsaw. Moving upstream past Krakow, towards its southern source, the Sowa and Przemysl meet the Wisła in a marshy area near the town of Oświęcim, where the river has historically become navigable. cubic meters of water an hour. The volume of flow that Dr. Otto Ambros, chairman of chemical conglomerate IG Farben's Committee for Rubber and Plastics, and implicated in the development of chemical weapons, calculated was required for the Buna rubber plant in 1941. During his testimony in the Nuremberg military tribunals, he pointed to this very map, identifying that the volume of water below the confluence of the Wisła, Sowa, and Przemysl was sufficient even at its minimum discharge of 6 cubic meters a second, or 21,600 cubic meters an hour, to locate the draining works, the chemical plant at Subcamp 3 Monowitz of the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex. In addition to the river's volume, the site was identified for its access to coal from Silesia, rail infrastructure, and what is referred to in Farben reports as a reservoir of Jewish manpower. Thus, the attraction to this location in 1941 was access to the combination of forced human, mineral, and riverine resources. By 1944, however, the rivers had been appropriated as a technology for the obfuscation of an altogether more disturbing substance. It was in the summer of this year that hundreds of thousands of deportees from Hungary began to arrive. The increased numbers initiated the development of alternative processes for removing the remains from the crematoria. And it was into these rivers, Sowa, at the immediate rear of Auschwitz I, these were a short distance from the rear of Auschwitz II, that ashes and pulverized bone were scattered. So you can see the rivers marked here, these were the Vistula, the Przemysl going up there, and then Sowa is coming up here. The scattering was done by the Sonderkommando, who were groups of predominantly Jewish men selected from transports and forced to carry out the processes of the gas chambers and the crematoria. Sonderkommando testimony exists through the remarkable survival of members, and in the form of diaries and texts buried in the ashes and earth of the site. These were often in improvised containers. Some of these buried testimonies were themselves, like messages in bottles, thrown with the ashes into the rivers. In return, many of the texts and testimonies that survive describe this very act of scattering. In a refusal of the erasure of trace sought by this co-option of riverine properties as a technology of obfuscation, I instead propose that with the scattering, these rivers became a dynamic archive of radically distinct forms of violence, industrially fast genocide, and the relative slowness of chemical pollutants. The pulverization of traces before the scattering itself replicates the sedimentary processes of erosion that would take place in the river itself. What I have learned in relation to this case is that the river does not merely erase nor archive, as in the relative stability of the earth of the former camps, now museums, but mediates these traces in space and time and can be read through a perception of the river as a complex sedimentary agent. Indeed, approached in this way, these rivers are both devices for telling a more expanded ecological story of Auschwitz-Birkenau and can be aid in the telling of the stories of riverine disappearances that result from forms of political violence elsewhere, including in Latin America, Rwanda, or on the Mekong River. Where rivers can be understood as part of the memorial politics of the site, They also act as archives of a confluent and ongoing politics in turbid motion within the river. So returning to that specific group, the Sonderkommando, called the Ashen Commando, who are charged with pulverizing the bones found amongst the ashes. Charles Cézanne, one of the survivors, stated that they had to smash the bone until it was, quote, no larger than pieces of gravel. And then using wooden poles, they pulverized it until it was dust. The actions of the SS certainly suggest an awareness of the potential for ash to bear trace. Another survivor, Eliza Eisenschmidt, articulated these acts. Quote, they didn't want it to be buried, the ashes in the pits, because they might be discovered one day and that might endanger them. Shlomo Dragon, a central witness of the Soviet Investigative Commission, emphasized the forensic effort of the SS. Not content with their reduction of the human body to ash, they removed the ashes to make impossible any trace of their crime. Quote, there were still bits of bone in the ashes. Trucks came and ashes were loaded onto them and then thrown into the Sowa River, which was nearby. We also had to take care of scattering the ashes. We did it under SS guard. The path between the road used by the trucks in the river was covered with sheets of cloth, so that not even a grain of ash would fall on the ground. To keep the ashes from sinking into the ground, the SS men wanted to throw it into the river and let the current carry them away, far away. We shook the sheets of cloth over the water and swept the place thoroughly. Other testimony describes this meticulous approach to the removal of remains in what appears to be an awareness of its possible local deposition. One describes the cleaning of the banks of the river to prevent it sinking into the earth. All of this in the belief that the earth and not the river would bear trace. Water has long been the element of forgetting par excellence. The pool of Mnemosyne in Greek mythology was where the memories washed from the feet of those crossing the river Lethe collect. This performs a strange act of recovery, where from the initial material dispersal on entering the riverine space, the lost memories collect as fragments in the archival pool at the end of the river. Perhaps this mythology has material truths, where river flows are not only modes of obfuscation, but by contrast, act as unexpected and dynamic archives. Hydrofeminist theorist Ashrita Namanis contends that water has the capacity to be a memory keeper or archive, storing flotsam, chemicals, detritus, sunken treasure, culture, stories, and history. Elsewhere, in Matthew Edgeworth's book, Archaeology of Flow, rivers are not ephemeral or abstract, but are in their own unique ways artifacts. He comes to see their, quote, cultural affordances just like solid artifacts. The difference is that their affordances tend to be associated with flowing energy rather than form. It is flow as much as form that is shaped and channeled for a vast range of instrumental uses, end quote. Edgeworth continues by asserting that it is in modern cultural perception that liquid is considered to lack the artifactual qualities so associated with solidity, or indeed with dryness. What then makes the capacities of a river as memory keeper or as artifact flow pose encountering forms of political violence that utilize rivers as infrastructures of erasure? So elsewhere, when forensic archaeologist Caroline Sturdy Coles asks of sites of the Holocaust, where are the bodies? She makes reference to archaeological anthropologist Richard Wright's working answer that they are in the ground and that this can be the only answer for the different practices attempting to locate these remains, especially when considering the social frictions and religious, ethical, and material challenges that are present. With Wright's question still at the forefront of my mind, I want to ask what occurs when the remains are not in the ground. What if they are also in other mediums, most notably in water? So we think back to Dragon's description of pulverization. We can see how this process replicates the slow erosion of submerged bone, a process that itself mimics the river's own characteristics. Sensing the Vizwa's turbulent fluvial processes then requires a multiplicity of approaches. This includes knowledge of the physical proportions of the material entering the river. In stream ecology, organic matter is typically divided into three categories: coarse particulate organic matter, CPOM, fine particulate organic matter, FPOM, and dissolved organic matter, DOM. This is the riverine spectrum of sedimentary erosion from material to immaterial, so from greater than 1 millimeter to between 1 millimeter and half a millimeter, and that which is beneath them. The heterogeneous ashes scattered into the river would include elements of all three categories, from the crushed and burned bones to the finest ashes. Each of these categories operates differently in different currents, the finest ash dissolving on contact. Likewise, they travel downstream towards the sea at different speeds, depending on the height of the water and the shape and incline of the riverbank or channel. The transportation of submerged remains across large distances offers numerous problems for archaeologists. So Tim Thompson and his colleagues consider the need for accurate interpretations of remains, submersion times, transport pathways, and provenances. He and his group performed experiments recording the abrasive effects of different sediment classes, silt, sand, and gravel, on submerged bone. You see a diagram of this here. Using microscopic methods, they observed evidence that the effect of abrasion from finer minerals in sortation, so sortation is the transport of particles in water flow, that abrasion rounds the bone and softens its surface, while the fewer impacts made by coarser materials, such as gravel, will produce cracking. The laboratory findings were verified against samples recovered from subaquatic contexts. Observing at microscopic level the material changes these bone samples had undergone, the team were able to record the periods of immersion and the forms of erosion they had encountered. This experimental laboratory study offers a partial knowledge of flow and sedimentary transportation, processes by which, transposed to the Vizwa, we can think of the already pulverized bone fragments to be slowly eroded, yet persisting within the river. From its sources in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains, leaves pass downstream in the Sowa's nearly imperceptible dune flow. I take one of the stones, still covered in the fine ash, forming the base of the fisherman's spire, and place it into the river. I stack two smaller pebbles on top of the broader one, a funerary gesture half submerged in the shallows. The ashes lift off the flat pebble into the almost imperceptible flow, and I imagine that 70 years or so ago, out of extermination, the finest of ash might have been caught in or filtered through the mossy web-like plants covering the pebbles, and there enter the mineral life of the river. In these flows, I imagine the riverine equivalent of the airborne archive of Paul Celan's Death Fugue, where he wrote, "Then as smoke you will rise into air, then a grave you will have in the clouds, there one lies unconfined." The unconfined materials of this grave of clouds figure as atmospheric feedback in Polish artist Elżbieta Janiczka's 2003 photographic series, The Odd Place. Janiczka took her photographs at Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor, Chełmno, and Buzets, speculating on the persistent, if visually ephemeral, presence of the ashes at the sites of extermination camps. By photographing the negative space of the atmosphere immediately above the site, Janiczka also attempts to discover where the body is not in the ground. Through the photographic medium, intentionally using AGFA film, then a subsidiary of Ige Farben during the Nazi period, Janicka points to a material absent presence within the frame of the image. This absent presence is unique to the materiality of ash, offering from the seeming impossibility the faintest possibility that the most minute particular presence is captured in the frame. Turning to these same dynamics of material ephemera and the imagination of time within fiction, Anne Michael's 1997 novel, Fugitive Pieces, concerns the rescue of a young Jewish boy, Jacob Beer, by Athos, a Greek archaeologist, paleobotanist, and geologist, working at the partially submerged Biskupin archaeological site in Poland. Whilst in hiding, the boy receives classes from his rescuer, and where all else is impossible, Jacob finds solace in geology. I stared at fossil plants called crinoids that looked like the night sky etched on rock. Athos said, "Sometimes I can't look you in the eye. You're like a building that's been burned out inside, with the outer walls left standing." To go back a year or two was impossible, absurd. To go back millennia, ah, that was nothing. Michael's novel meditates on the encoding of memory in air currents and river sediments. And when recent memory becomes impossible, recourse is made to the dual scalar extremes, the molecular and deep temporalities. It is in the imagination that such incomprehensibilities shift and fold, and likewise through the imagination that, confronted by the impossible, I make recourse back to the rivers. And in doing so, I take inspiration from the Sabaku's search for absent presences in a very different context. The poet M. Norbise Philip forcefully addresses the continuing presence of the dead within the saltwater archive of the Atlantic Ocean. Her cycle of poems, Zon, reverberates with the continuing trauma of the Middle Passage and slaves thrown overboard from the slave ship Zon in 1781. In her introduction, Philip asks a potent question of Sabaku's remains. Quote, "What is the word for bringing bodies back from water, from a liquid grave? The gravestone or tombstone marks the spot of interment, whether of ashes or the body. What marks the spot of subaquatic death? With no word in existence to truly encompass that concept, Philip coins the term exaqua, the aquatic equivalent of exhumation. Despite the assumption that there could be no retrieval, Philip nevertheless aligns herself with the sentiments of forensic archaeologist Clea Koch, who, like so many, wants the bones back, even after so many years. For Philip, the Zong symbolizes the hauntological operation where the undead make themselves present. As an entrance into oceanic memory, Zong goes and enters into the saltwater, seawater, and as the ocean appears to be the same, yet is constantly in motion, affected by tidal movements, so too this memory appears stationary, yet is shifting always. Repetition drives the event and the memory simultaneously, becoming a haunting, becoming spectral in its nature," end quote. Over time, with decomposition, the watery archive resists the possibility of exequation in a physical way, yet mourning persists with the hope for effective or emotional exaqua. Into the riverine archive, I follow a similar impulse for clarity, not to exhume necessarily or exaqua per se, but to pursue a hydrological or sedimentary knowledge of these remains through the perhaps irresolvable conditions of the river, and thus achieve an exaqua in the imagination, at least. Such a sense of submerged remaining benefits from another Black Studies figure in the scholar Christina Shah, who carefully renders the concept of residence time in her book In the Wake on Blackness and Being. Sharp leads her reader through the processes of a body's inequation to calculate how long the body would take to sink, and for how long any remains might exist. Finally, with the help of Anne Gradolski, professor of stratigraphy and sedimentology, Sharp comes to the conclusion that it is unlikely that a body thrown from a ship would make it to the seafloor intact. In words that are similar to Richard Wright and Caroline Sturdy Coles, Sharp asks Gradolski what happened to the bodies. But here she adds the subaqueous specificity, by which I mean what happened to the components of the bodies in salt water. Sharp recounts Gradolski's answer that through the nutrient cycles of the ocean, the atoms of these bodies still exist today. Sharp explores this continuing existence through her method of wake work and the analysis of residence time borrowed from fluid dynamics, recounting Gradolski's own definition. The amount of time it takes for a substance to enter the ocean and then leave the ocean is called residence time. Human blood is salty, and sodium, Gradolski tells me, has a residence time 260 million years. And what happens to the energy that is produced in the waters? It continues cycling like atoms in residence time. We, Black people, exist in the residence time, the wake, end quote. The search for traces that Sharp endeavors to pursue enters the ocean's nutrient cycle through the slow breaking down into the particulate, but also temporally into the present and extending into deep future. This, in some way, achieves a partial exequation from oblivion to the imaginary informed by submerged processes, by scientific knowledge of those processes. While the conditions I'm pursuing are culturally and materially different, perhaps Sharp and Gradolski's evocation of residence time can provide a cautious precedent for the pursuit of riverine traces in the distinct context of the Sowa and Viswa. Rivers and oceans do not operate in the same ways, just as the ashes and bones, partially broken down by fire and drought and pulverization, are in a different material state to the throwing of entire bodies overboard. The pulverization itself would contribute to the acceleration of residence time, of the calcinated bone and ashes dissolving or suspended and carried downstream in the current of the river. The different sizes of this organic matter, that CPOM, FPOM, DOM that I mentioned before, are distinct as they enter the water and are processed differently. Likewise, the residence time of the ocean is a vast system of currents and organisms dwarfing that of a river. The residence time of a river, on the other hand, is the length of time a water particle and the river's biogeochemical contents take to be transported to the river's mouth and into a further body of water, be that lake, sea, or ocean. Through this transportation, solvency of trace reverberates into both the present and future. It is thus into the changed course and present waters of the Viswa that I return. Walking along a fisherman's path, I first approach the Viswa. As the sun reaches the fullness of its June height, the path narrows amongst dense grass and nettles, from which rise a flight of almost black damselflies. Where the path ends at what I assume is the river, I step into the remnants of another small fisherman's fire, this time scorched into the grass. On each occasion that I meet the rivers, I come across ashes and scorched pebbles and earth. And I wonder, are they actually fisherman's fires or strange votive offerings? I can only project onto the site the unsettling coincidence of these other ashes and the histories of these waters. Removing my foot from its imprint in the fire, the placid damselflies are quickly replaced by the bites of mosquitoes, emerging from what I find is not the river itself, but the still oxbow lake of an isolated meander formed by the Viswa's shifting course. At the fringes of the 2018 COP24 climate summit in Katowice, the capital of Silesia, Poland's major coal mining region, trade union Solidarność, or Solidarity, and US climate denial group Heartland released a statement rejecting IPCC warnings of imminent climate catastrophe. the sparsely attended event in the center of Katowice, just an hour drive north of Oswiecim, was an unambiguous attempt to reject threats to the region's mining future and associated employment prospects. In recent years, however, evidence has emerged of the local impact of anthropogenic climate change, in particular those unprecedentedly low summer levels of the region's often polluted rivers. These droughts represent the return, the impacts of changing planetary systems to localities where carbon-emitting resources are mined. I adapt the term heavy rivers here from post-colonial literary scholar Elizabeth de Lowry's concept, heavy waters. She employs it as an analytical tool to explore the overlaps of the cultural and material content of the Atlantic. These heavy waters precipitate from modernity's multiple violent practices against human bodies and towards environments. De Lowry states that the Latin term vastus signifies the ocean as well as waste. It is considered to be of such unimaginable spatial and temporal scale and solubility that it has been deemed to be able to safely consume near infinite polluting materials, as if they were able to vanish everything into thin waters. Elsewhere, the inhuman geographer Catherine Yusof conceives of duration to counteract how capital relies, quote, on the non-contemporaneity of environments that absorb, sink, store, and accumulate its material wastes long after it has moved on to new markets. That is, understanding duration as a form of responsibility to the ongoing material and immaterial recombinations of matter that exceed social action, end quote. This vast scale of Yusof's duration resists the attempt to make immaterial the devastation of environments and peoples by the excesses of capital. The rivers themselves are sites of duration in this sense of recombinations of sediments and microbial life, long after the temporality of scattering human remains or the introduction of industrial pollutants. Investigating the confluent histories of ecological degradation and human violence in the Wisła, Sowa, and Przemysza reveals the durational histories and futurities of riverine sites, including the history of industry alongside the river and the increasing frequency and severity of droughts. Likewise, navigating the encounter between the distinct materialities of culturally sensitive remains, the water management of genocide, and ongoing anthropogenic pollutants, pesticides, and industrial waste reveals in sediment records Poland's own heavy rivers. As with many major waterways, the Wisła is of commercial importance. Heavy industry, especially the coal mines of Silesia, introduced 9,000 tons of sulfates and chlorides per day. Much of the major metal pollutants entering Poland's rivers are found in the relatively small and heavily industrialized distance between the Wisła's source and Kraków, including the segments of river that I described near to the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex. The history of pollution also includes the former IG Farben chemical and Buna rubber works and the infrastructural flow rate calculated by Ambros in 1941. Now operating under the company Chemoservice Dvory SA, that factory remains a large-scale factory concerned with the repair and maintenance of machinery used in the chemical industry. Indeed, as recently as 2005, it was the 164th largest company in Poland and has long been a major employer in the town. In response to dangerous levels of pollution and threats to river health, groups such as Siostry Rzeki, Sisters of the River, have emerged as river defenders to raise awareness and protect the rivers of Poland. To achieve a critical proximity with the water, they employ methods of submergence, swimming in rivers, and protesting to draw attention to the threats posed by high levels of pollution and of major infrastructure projects such as dams and the E40 waterway project, which was proposed to link the Baltic and Black Sea through many of the region's major waterways. Bringing attention to all of Poland's rivers, the River Sisters practice defense in a way that understands the confluence of waters feeding into one another, and with that, the histories of different materialities and politics. In doing so, they foreground the rivers as crucial cultural elements of the nation's past, present, and future, elements devastated by extractive and exploitative environmental practices. Their practice is also inspired by hydrofeminist theory, including the work of Astrida Naimonis, who considers water to be a complex archive. In the context of thinking issues of planetary climate change and modes of becoming aware of human relationality with the environment and through water, Naimonis writes that even while in constant motion, water is a planetary archive of meaning and matter. To drink a glass of water is to ingest the ghosts of bodies that haunt that water. When nature calls sometime later, we return to the system and the sea, not only our antidepressants, our chemical estrogens, or our more commonplace excretions, but also the meanings that permeate these materialities, disposable culture, medicalized problem solving, ecological disconnect. Just as the deep oceans harbor particulate records of former geological eras, water retains our more anthropomorphic secrets, even when we would rather forget. Our distant and more immediate pasts are returned to us in both trickles and floods. In a separate passage of his testimony, Ambrose stated that because the site was between 14 and 23 meters above the river's level, it was safe from flooding. Farben were conscious of water as a relationally multidirectional substance necessary to remove waste, those 15,000 cubic meters of water an hour. But likewise, concerned by the threat posed by the river when it breaks its banks and encroaches on the industrial plant. Nearby, the SS were also concerned with the extermination infrastructure's own relational impact on groundwater. They feared that the number of bodies buried in the site might pollute the local water table and contribute to risks of disease for both the local Polish and German population. In response to these concerns, the regional infrastructure was mobilized to identify where best to place a wastewater processing plant. This fear contributed to the decision to move from the practice of mass burial to Paul Blobel's model of cremation developed at Helmer during Sonderaktion 1005. Blobel developed a process whereby the dead were also reduced to ash and scattered into the local rivers there. Echoing the industrial instrumentalization of the river, the extermination machine adopted its own water management genocide. Historians Deborah Dvork and Robert Jan van Pelt identified the site as surrounded by lakes and reservoirs and industrial canals running immediately north of the site, which was subsequently dug to straighten the flow of the Weser, end quote. Adding to the mythology of the site, and perhaps inaccurate in reality, historian of the Sonderkommando, Burr Mark, has speculated that it was chosen because it was, quote, a damp and pernicious area between the Weser and the Sowa, whose water is so unsafe that it must be boiled before drinking. In other words, Mark continues, and any extended sojourn in that area is hazardous to human health, end quote. Indeed, Rudolf Hess described not wanting the water from the area to touch his mouth. After its use for extermination, the camp was intended to become a model agricultural project for the wider Eastern colonial expansion. Thus, water resources were a crucial component within almost all aspects of the Auschwitz complex, because the area surrounding the confluence regularly floods and would not naturally drain easily. For agriculture to succeed at the scale that was imagined, the saturated earth would need to be irrigated properly. In 1941, soil scientists commissioned by Hirst suggested the need for major hydrological improvements of the Wisła and Sowa to prevent flooding, cleaning up existing drainage channels and digging new ones, and laying a massive network of 3.6 million drainage pipes in 3,000 acres of future farmland. By early 1942, work had begun. Tens of thousands of laborers, predominantly women, were forced to dig the drainage ditch. They worked, the survivor Hannah Kent Starksman described, standing in this icy water, to maintain the banks of the Vizsla through the forced labor manipulating the shape of the rivers to prevent flooding. Thus, the rivers were shaped by labor from the camps while simultaneously being used to discard the remains of genocide. Thus, at the level of infrastructural intervention, the history of Auschwitz-Birkenau is also a water history. Between these hydrological interventions and its mobilization as technology of obfuscation, the Vizsla, even at the most traced level, is an artifact, what I elsewhere call a necrohydrologic infrastructure. And so to conclude, I'm sure I've been speaking far too long, in these heavy waters, radically different forces, the forms of violence, that industrially fast genocide and the slowness of toxicity are entangled as traces of Western modernity in river sediment. The elements that give chemical and cultural weight to these waters may no longer be discernible, but have become over time confluent, dispersed, diluted, and deposited in the river's currents and sediments. And so here, the interlapping of these materials and flows makes the rivers themselves dynamic cultural artifacts. 15,000 cubic meters of water an hour. That innocuous calculation of flow hides an altogether more weighty meaning when read against the scattering of all those ashes and bone, near comprehensible scales of life and death in the river. I have shown how the measurement of water is a political process, technology within different and imbricating contexts, from pollution to genocide. What I propose is to adopt a perspective that can imagine the existence of ashes in the process of water, its flows, transportation, sedimentation. But it's simply when something dissolves in water, even in a very minute way, it in some ways becomes that thing. I'm thus attempting to produce tools with contemporary relevance to counteract the assumed abyssal qualities of subaqueous space, or even that rivers are ambiguous features where political violence can take place without impunity. Indeed, perhaps this perspective can contribute to understanding the extent to which the dynamic archive of politics in Poland's rivers is still being added to. For example, in the recent weaponization of rivers against migrants at the borders of Poland and Belarus, as explored so sensitively by the group Border Emergency Collective, whose investigative film, Zone of Hidden Violence, was recently displayed in the Warsaw Biennale. And by thinking with these flow rates and sediments and the river as a dynamic archive, a memory device that mediates these fragments through present river conditions and a process through which events and their multiple material and political implications, their interlapping politics, can be narrated. In this way, the mimetic operation of pulverizing remains did not only result in the desired erasure. Unexpectedly, the adoption of the river as technology enabled the possibility of reading the traces through fluvial process. In the dynamic space of water, traces continue to exist and encounter other objects, even within the material processes designed to condemn them to oblivion. This riverine infrastructure has produced a fluvio-geomorphological, enters into fluvio-geomorphological process, perhaps even a young riverine geology of genocide, a process slowly revealed by lowering river levels as the cubic meters of water per hour slowly reduce season by season and year on year. Thus, I continue to ask whether the knowledge of riverine processes can be a stand-in for the absent presence of materials. Can hydrological awareness contribute to an archaeology of eroding traces? By asking these questions, I refuse the subaqueous as a space of complete erasure, but instead read the memory of dispersed fragments back through the riverine, the water's own processes, and ask whether the memory of life and death can remain confluent in the flows of a river. Thank you.